Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Christopher Sebu.
Hello, hello, hello. I don't know why I did that, though. I don't know why I did that.
Oh, I love it. I quite liked it myself.
Hi.
Oh, it's very good. Jessica, I did not tell you this earlier, but Christopher does go by Christopher. There's no abbreves here. There's no Chris. It's Christopher.
Yeah, it is Christopher. Yep.
Look, I love saying Christopher.
But whatever you have time for, that's fine.
Look, you are allowed to, you are allowed to take up space.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
I'm taking it all.
You take it.
We want that for you, Christopher. And since I do quite love a Staten Island, Long Island accent, you know that Christopher, for me, is going to be one of my favorite words to say. Christopher, please, Christopher. Yeah,
from
Christopher.
Sopranos.
Oh, yeah. I'm from Jersey.
Christopher. Yeah,
that's my Jersey jam. Christopher, don't do the drugs, Christopher. No.
Don't inject it between your toes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can't find the vein there. Anyway. Also, a big fan of Intervention here. Hey, Annie, how are you? But yeah, okay. I understand, Jen. I can follow the rules.
Great.
I'll follow them.
Which is not, you're my little balloon. That's not necessarily easy for you. Like, oh, she's going to the left.
No.
Oh, she's going to the right.
Oh yeah. Oh. No, I am. Whoa. I'm full of the helium. She's squirrel of the century. Mm. La la la. Yeah. Yeah. We're okay. So, I'm here.
Okay.
For everyone here who's listening to us, for all of our killers who are listening, you already know that Christopher is a 2-time Tony Award nominee. Major star
or loser, whatever you'd like to, you know.
Okay.
I mean, nominated.
I didn't make it awkward. I just want to say that I didn't say it. So, everyone here, everyone, and my Italian hands have come out. There they are.
There they are.
My friend Christopher is a 2-time Tony Award nominee, as we like to say it, and also a huge star of stage and screen. And despite, you know, your incredibly fantastic career, today we don't want to talk about that at all.
Let's move on.
Oh, we're going to move on. Okay. All right. And, you know, at any Love point, it. If we need to get therapeutic, you know, or at least our listeners know now.
Oh, I think we
now.
All could use some therapy.
Oh, honey,
too.
Yeah, bring it on. I have therapy today.
Oh, you do? Good for
that's
you.
That's right, with a new therapist. Let's hope she's
all
what's
right. Up.
Don't talk about me. It'll kill me.
Oh, darling, I would never.
Teasing. Talk away.
I would never.
Jess is absolutely right, Christopher. We don't talk about our careers here on this little podcast. But we've often wondered, are we serial killers? Or like today's case, like, am I a vampire? Do I sleep upside down when I wake up at 2 a.m. to go to the fridge? Is that blood on my mouth or ketchup? I'm not sure. So,
very good.
So, Christopher, I know we've discussed this, but as far as an interest in true crime, you know, what is your interest, if any, or better, like, I think we discussed maybe a show that you like.
Yeah.
Inform us.
Unsolved Mysteries. I think, is it on the History Channel or is it on CNN? I can't remember which it was.
Well, but it's everywhere now. It's syndicated.
Yeah. It's Unsolved Mysteries, and the host voice is Stacey Keach, I think, he has this voice, and he's like, then the true crime happened, and blah, 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 and it was great. Those are fun. I like those. And then American Greed, too, but that's not like murder stuff. That's just like greed, but I like that kind of stuff.
Well, then to piggyback on this, why do you think that we entertainers, theatrical types, why do we gravitate to true crime? What's your diagnosis?
Well, because it's always a mystery, isn't it? Mm. You don't know. You don't know what it is. You find out the crime and then you're like, oh, what happened? Let's dig a little deeper. Let's find out what happened. And then it's drama and then it's exciting. And then there's justice at the end. And then there's a happy ending. Hopefully.
I was going to say.
Hopefully. Unsolved Mysteries. You never know.
I know. And now I believe it's on Netflix. Not that they sponsor us, but whatever. Yeah, I must agree.
Well, Christopher, like Rose Nyland, you grew up in Minnesota. Is that
I
correct?
I did grow up in rural Minnesota, a little town called Wyoming. Wyoming, Minnesota, population 642 people.
Oh, my.
Wow. So when people say, yeah, I came from a small town, they're like, yeah, we had 15,000 people. It's like, oh, no, you didn't. I knew everybody in town. And it was crazy. We didn't even have, when that we moved there, crazy. we didn't even have a four-way stop. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
We didn't have a four-way stop. And we had a grocery store, a hardware store, a elementary school, and a gas station. And that is it. It was crazy.
And, and no street lights. Did you have like a rural route post office?
We did. We had the rural route post office, but we also had dirt roads for a while, and then they paved them. And I remember the day they paved all the streets in town. We were like, oh my God, we're rich. but it was crazy. Everybody did know everybody. And within a 10 mile radius, everybody knew everybody. You know, it's that whole thing. It's like, oh, Mr. Barslow over there in the barn, what's he doing with the yarn?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We knew everybody. So I moved.
I mean, I would have done the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you still have family there?
Yeah, everybody's there except my cousin Elizabeth and I are the only ones who escaped Minnesota. Everybody else lives very close to each other. My brothers live very close to my parents, and my parents live very close to all their siblings as well. My brother's 5 blocks away, and my other brother's 5 miles away from my parents. Mm-hmm. And it's like Minnesota people don't leave. They don't leave. Uh-huh. They stay. Well, why would you want to go anywhere else? It's so nice here, eh?
Killers, our story today takes place in Minnesota, and it takes place specifically in a place called St. Cloud. And I will say, because I'm a Golden Girls fan, every time we say that, I just think St. Olaf. Sorry about it. I'm really sorry. And now you will too. But St. Cloud, how far is that from Wyoming, Minnesota?
It's surprisingly close. St. Cloud is in the center of the state, and we were on the eastern side of the state, close to the St. Croix River, but it's almost a direct shot across a little bit south. But for the most part, St. Cloud is right in the middle of the state, and it's probably about an hour away, I think.
Oh, that's not far at all.
Not far at all. No.
And you texted us that you do remember this case.
Oh yeah. No. When you told me about it, I was like, why does that? It sounds familiar. And then I looked at it and I was like, of course, that's what it was. It was like so crazy because I was in high school still. Mm-hmm. And you know, the news, KSTP and WCCO Channel 4, they were all talking about this crazy homeless man, I think, right? It was a homeless guy that was
stabbed,
and then his body was dumped in the Mississippi River, and they became it was a whole thing. They drank his blood. That's what everybody was saying. Like, they drank his blood.
Well, that's it. Thank you for listening, killers. That's the story.
Did I just give it away?
No, it's perfect. It's what we want. And Jessica, do you want to inform him, because he told part of the story, his official title now?
I do, since you've basically given us the
everything,
the footnotes to the real story today. So for everybody listening, like, it's been a pleasure. What you are today is Dr. Sieber. We are all doctors of crime when we're discussing these crimes. So as we move forward, when you hear the title, the apropos title, you know, Doc S, that's for you. So you can choose your specialty, but you are a doctor of crime at this time. Dr. Seuss over here.
You're
a doctor of crime at this time. How sublime. Made an end man. Okay. Okay. Well, take it, Jen.
I'm finally a doctor. My mom would be so proud.
See? You are, Mr. Look at us.
So, as we've been discussing, this case does take place in Christopher Sieber's, Dr. Sieber's home state of Minnesota.
Yes, doctor.
And we all, doctor. Now, first, we always like to give credit where that is due. And today we got our info from law.justia.com and newspapers.com. This is the vampire murder. Our story starts in St. Cloud, Minnesota, in the spring of 1988. Timothy Michael Erickson, then 18 years of age, and his 19-year-old brother Mark shared an apartment. From time to time, the brothers sheltered homeless or runaway teenagers. And in March 1988, 4 other teenagers between the ages of 15 and 17, 2 of them girls, were staying there. Sometime around March 15th, Mark, the resident teenagers, a person by the name of Bill Benedict, and 3 other 15-year-old boys talked about forming a vampire cult. Apparently, Mark, one of the brothers, became fascinated with the subject after watching a movie about teenage vampires, and he began asking Benedict about the occult. Most of the teens, aka witnesses, later said that they thought then that Mark was merely joking about forming a vampire cult. On March 21st, 1988, 7 of the young men, including both Erickson brothers, i.e. Timothy and Mark, and Donald Gall, the victim in this case, the homeless person that Dr. Sieber mentioned earlier, decided to go camping in Riverside Park near St. Cloud. At about 11:30 that evening, Gall arrived at the Erickson apartment sloppy drunk before they left for their outing. He'd also smoked some marijuana, apparently. As the group prepared to leave, Benedict became uneasy and he left the party. Smart man. About 1 a.m., the remaining six set off for the campsite. Timothy brought a case of beer, some marijuana, and ephedrine, an over-the-counter stimulant. One of the group brought hot dogs. Fred Fosk would love this campsite, Jess.
God bless.
A 15-year-old with them brought what is now known as the murder weapon, but this was a fixed-blade hunting knife. He was later heard to mention to Timothy something about, quote, the first victim. For a couple of hours, the group sat around their campfire near the edge of the frozen river and drank beer, smoked marijuana, ate hot dogs, hey, Fred Bosk, and they talked about women, hunting, drugs, jail, and motorcycles. At about 4:30 a.m., one of the men left because he was cold and tired, and Donald Gall lay down near the fire. After Gall fell asleep, the four remaining campers went into the woods where Timothy suggested that they kill Gall and drink his blood. He told the others that they could wake Gall and that he would kill him with the knife that the 15-year-old had brought. Mark Erickson, Timothy's brother, refused to participate in the plan. As the group returned to the campfire, Timothy pulled his knife from its sheath and approached Gall. Gall suddenly awoke. Timothy told Gall they would keep the fire going and that he should go back to sleep. The group then returned to the woods to revise their plan. This time, Timothy told the others that he would club Gall while he slept and that the others should kick him. Timothy's brother, Mark, again refused to participate in the plan to murder.
Well, of course he did. Why would you want... No. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. Dr. Sieber, what did you do? What you doing over there?
I'm just like listening to the whole description that you just laid out, and it is... Wow. Can you... I mean, just what is it? What happened to these people? I mean, why are they doing this? It's awful.
Yeah.
You know? I mean...
So cold-blooded. You know,
it's so cold-blooded. It's just, I mean, suggested, yeah, let's just, I'm going to kill this guy. Yeah, let's just kill him. For yucks? Mm-hmm. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
My mouth was a tape the entire time Jennifer was like, mm-hmm. What?
I mean, same. It's like, it's truly disgusting. And here again, we like to, you know, trigger warning area. This is it, kids. So the group returns to the campfire where Timothy clubbed Gall over the head with a tree branch. And then while the other two kicked Gall, Timothy continued to beat him with the tree branch. And after Gall lost consciousness, Timothy then, he takes his knife from the 15-year-old, he pulls Gall's head into the air and slit his throat. So Gall bleeds to death. And Timothy and his two accomplices then licked Gall's blood from their hands. And next... they removed his leather jacket and his wristwatch. They lifted his wallet. They emptied his pockets. And when Timothy announced, quote, we've got to get rid of the body, the three assailants pushed Gall's body off of the river ice into open water.
I remember them finding the body. I remember the news and that they said, yeah, we found the body that was dumped into the river. And it was crazy. There were helicopter shots and everything around. But it's a very Minnesota thing to be camping. Constantly, everybody has a camper or a tent.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's a very big thing. So for them to go camping in kind of spring is no surprise. That's not the unusual part about that. Minnesota people love it outside. They love being outside. They love camping, being away from their home at a campground or a state park. So that's nothing new. That's nothing crazy. But the fact that they found a homeless guy. Killed him and then dumped him in the, and then didn't they wear his jacket? Did they wear his jacket?
Well, I don't know, but my thing also is, and then you licked your hands of his blood.
Yeah. I wouldn't even do that. What's with happening? Like a steak, with a steak that I'm cooking.
I know. I honestly wouldn't even wash my, this is the Coco Roro kid.
I get grossed out about, you know, like if I cut my finger and I lick my own finger.
Oh yeah. It's like, not. Yeah.
It tastes so irony.
Yeah, you're like, where's my Band-Aid? I want it to be a see-through band. But it's like, it's just so gross. And, but this group doesn't stop there. Like, they stay the rest of the evening, the sun rises, and they're like, we got to clean the campsite. So that's what they do. And Timothy puts his log club into the campfire, takes a different route home to avoid detection. And then the group stops at a convenience store to buy cigarettes with money taken from Gall. So that's also good when you're not going to heaven. Hate to tell you. and then Also, following the return home, Timothy tells both of the girls who were staying with the Erickson brothers that he had killed Gaul by beating him with a log and stabbing him with a knife, and that he had thrown Gaul's body into the river. Timothy bragged that he had drunk Gaul's blood and then licked the blood from his hands. Gaul's blood-soaked jacket and other items taken from Gaul were exhibited as proof of the crime. So there you go, Dr. Siebes.
Ding, ding.
He was probably like, check this out, you know.
And did he think proof. That that would, you know, impress the girls?
Is probably. That, yeah. That? Probably.
Why, hey, I killed somebody. You want a little, you know, get a little bit for me? Yeah?
But can you imagine though, if he was like, guess what I did, you know, A yeah. through Z, 1 through 5, and then I licked the blood off of my hands. Can you imagine her? She's like, oh my gosh.
Oh my God. There's take a CD, it out. Take you know, it
there's
out.
There's a CD Hawkins dance. And I think that you're my pick.
Let me see it.
Oh yeah. Let me see it. And so this is just all gross. And so we get to that morning. So that morning, Mark Erickson described the killing to Benedict. And that evening, Timothy told Benedict about the murder, saying that Gaul's death was, quote, not really that big of a deal. And at about 4 a.m., I know.
No big deal.
Nobody's going to miss him.
I mean, that's what you say when you, like, don't tie the garbage before you put it down the garbage chute. You're sort of like, meh, oops. So that's where I'm thinking, like, there's something wrong up there. So now we're at about 4 a.m. on March 24th of 1988, where a drunken Benedict wanders into the St. Cloud Law Enforcement Center and reports the murder. And Gaul's body was soon discovered floating in the river a short distance downstream from the campsite. And shortly thereafter, Timothy was arrested at the St. Cloud bus terminal. And he was taken to the interrogation room at the Law Enforcement Center, where he was advised of his Miranda rights. So he initially denied any involvement in the murder, but testing showed the presence of blood on his jacket and boots. And there you have Timothy crying and finally confessing to the murder. What a poor little baby. And this initial confession, bummer, because we love listening to a confession, was not recorded, but he immediately repeated his confession to a police stenographer.
So moving on, the trial was bifurcated. Timothy's defense in the first phase of the trial was that voluntary intoxication had rendered him incapable of forming an intention to murder.
Lie. I'm sorry. You know, I get passionate, right. And that is bold-faced.
Well, it is. And what an excuse for so many of us this year.
Oops, I got drunk pandemic. Last night. Murdered
I got drunk. Yeah.
Oh my God. I don't remember it. Oh, I must have blacked out.
Crazy. It was so dark and I was so drunk. That's what like people who are in the closet say. Oh Christ, was I drunk last night? I don't know what happened.
Uh-huh.
But why is this?
Where was my hand? In my bed?
Well, needless to say, the jury found him guilty of murder in the first degree. Now, in the second phase of the trial, hashtag bifurcated, Timothy contended that mental illness had rendered him incapable of knowing the nature of his act or that it was wrong. The jury still, they weren't buying it. And they
Nobody's buying that.
Yeah. They reaffirmed the guilty verdict. So on appeal, Timothy first contended that he met his burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence that he was so intoxicated when Gaul was killed that he was rendered incapable of forming either the intent to kill or the premeditation necessary to the crime of first-degree murder. There was evidence of his history of chemical abuse, that he had consumed a great deal of beer and ephedrine and had smoked marijuana during the day and night before he killed Gaul, together with evidence that his high tolerance of drugs and alcohol allows him to mask the physiological effects of these chemicals and to appear normal to others, which would have permitted the jury to conclude that he was unable to intend or premeditate the murder. However, two witnesses testified that Timothy appeared sober during and immediately after the murder. There was also other evidence of deliberation on the part of Timothy, i.e. that he had formulated a plan of murder and then revised the plan. You remember they go back and forth. There were two brief sessions in the assault when Gaul fell unconscious, if you recall. The attackers dragged Gaul from the river's edge back to the campfire and propped him against a tree before Timothy purposefully slit his throat. And it was noted that it was Timothy's decision to clean up the murder site and to take an alternate route home to avoid detection. That was also red flags for everyone not buying it, of course.
Right, right. All of that, you know, taking the different route. Ding, ding,
yeah.
ding.
Yeah. Not just for the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. He ain't no dummy. So Timothy asserted that the jury was required, y'all, to excuse him from criminal responsibility because of the evidence of his fascination with the occult and the testimony of his expert witness, who's a licensed psychologist, who gave his opinion that the defendant was suffering from an organic personality syndrome, which, truthfully, I mean, I do. I also shop at Whole Foods. I feel I have an organic personality syndrome. The two of you, would you hop on board with me on this?
What is organic personality?
I mean, don't know, but it sounds like something we'd all. Yeah, we all have it. Christopher, you have it. I have it.
Because it's, all of us are organically.
We're organically grown.
We are not modified. We are non-GMO.
Non-GMO. No.
I like to walk in to whatever natural food market and I say, guys, I have OPD. And and when I walk in and I say, I have OPD, they're like, do you want the you know, where's the salmon that you want from the wild caught waters off of the coast of Jersey? And I say, guys, OPD, you guys. And so, that's where I feel it comes from. And so his psychologist, licensed as it were, says, guess what? He has organic personality disorder, which could have easily been caused by some chemical abuse. And as a result, the defendant, i.e. Timothy, he did not know the wrongfulness of his acts when he killed Gall. Now there was, however, testimony from a psychologist and a psychiatrist who observed Timothy and evaluated his condition during his 60-day stay at the Minnesota State Security Hospital. That's good that he did that. And it was their conclusion that he exhibited some antisocial behavior, but that he did not suffer from any mental illness and that he knew the wrongfulness of his act when he murdered Gall. Duh. So Timothy argues that the evidence of his delusional thoughts about the occult and vampires somehow undercuts the opinion testimony that he was not mentally ill. Riddle me that. Can you imagine? Like, listen, I love watching vampires and I just wanted to try it. I really think that that's.
And it's like a LARPing. Are you LARPing? What is, you know, we're really going to do this. We're going to go into the woods and be the lost boys and we're going to bite somebody. We're going to, you know,
It's not whether the defendant is psychotic or has an antisocial personality, which happens to be organic, but it's instead whether the defendant has proved by a preponderance of the evidence that because of mental illness or because of mental deficiency, that he didn't know the nature of his act or that it was wrong at the actual time of the murder. And Timothy also contends that it was an error for the trial court to admit his 14-page custodial confession, which he claims was not only coerced, but was obtained in violation to his right to counsel. Lies. They read you your Miranda rights, silly. So to surmise, because Timothy tries every angle that he could, which I'm guessing any defendant in this situation would probably try every possible route. So that makes sense. But he thinks that three circumstances taken together amounted to the coercion of his confession. A, he was only 18 years old with almost no previous contact with the criminal system when he was arrested. B, he had a history of psychological problems. And C, he is addicted to chemicals and Clorox? And the detectives left his half-emptied bottle of wine on the table before him during the interrogation. I don't buy it. I still don't buy it, y'all. Yeah.
They left a bottle of wine? They brought wine into the confession room?
Well, it was It was half-emptied bottle of wine. And all it makes me think of, you guys, is that emoji with the two side eyeballs, like just him sitting there, give me some of that. I need some of that drink, you know, just the whole time. side eyeball emoji. Jess, we got it. When we post this episode, can we please put side eyeball emoji in the post?
You know how love a side eye. I dig a side eye. I thrive on a side eye.
All right.
Yeah. Like this guy's in the confession room was like, excuse me, I'm just going to, No.
Yeah.
I pour myself a glass of wine while you're talking. Let me ponder this over a nice rosé. may or may not have killed this guy. Cheers. <Yeah. laughs>
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-Step, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song.
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
So as we all know, all of us doctors and you doctor listeners, a coerced confession is, of course, inadmissible. And it was for the prosecution to prove that the confession was made voluntarily. Now, while young, 18, there is no evidence, of course, that Timothy was coerced into confessing involuntarily. Although the defendant was new to the criminal justice system, the police advised him of his constitutional rights as enunciated in Miranda before the interrogation began, and again before his confession was recorded by the stenographer. In addition, they gave him written advisement of his Miranda rights. Nor does the fact that the police left the contents of his pockets, including Gall's wristwatch and the aforementioned opened bottle of wine, in the interrogation room suggest psychological torture resulting in a confession. I mean, if a half open bottle of wine is psychological torture for you, then boo, you need to go to a meeting.
Yeah, you gotta say, hi, my name is, and I am having problems. I mean, that's not right.
Yeah.
That's not right. Right. I mean, yeah. And at this point, we're going to call him, instead of Timothy, we're just call him Mr. I'm going to try and get at this by every angle. And he.
No, I didn't. No, yeah. I didn't. No, yeah. I didn't.
No, I did. They left a Cabernet. No. And he contends ineffective assistance of counsel. Of course he does. And that his confession was obtained in violation of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. So, I mean, I call that a flip-flop right there. He's like, I don't even like my counsel, but I needed them. I can't. So all of this, he tries. And, you know, you can't knock a guy for trying unless he's a vampire. And he really hopes that he's going to get a new trial. He really does. But regarding his Sixth Amendment right to counsel, here's just a bit of the recorded tape between the officer and Timothy in the interrogation room, which will be reenacted by Dr. Samard and myself. Ooh. Jen will play the role of the officer, okay. And I will be Timothy. And I just wanted to say, as an addendum to this, if anybody, after you hear this reenactment, mm-hmm. if anyone from Law and Order, Warren Late, I'm looking at you.
Dick Wolf, even.
And you know? Dick. Hey, Dick Wolf. Cast us. In your, and again, I've said it once, I've said it a million times, I will play a dead person. Okay.
All right. So Christopher.
Yes.
You're going to play the role of casting at Law and Order and give us some notes.
Oh yeah. You let us know.
You want to come in the room first or?
Let's come in the room.
Sure.
I'm assuming that you guys got the sides and yes. And do you guys know each other?
No, hi, Jessica. I'm your scene partner, Jennifer.
Jessica.
Great, great. And I believe, Jennifer, you were given the side of the officer? Yeah.
Yes, I was. Yes.
And then mm-hmm. and then you are the you are, I believe, the murderer.
I am no pronoun. So,
okay. So yeah. What you guys want to do, just you know, feel free, be yourself.
Okay.
You know, just loosen up and just be yourself and just, you know, talk like you're in a room.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
And here we go.
When you're ready.
Okay. Have you been advised? Nope. I'm sorry, Christopher.
No, that's okay. People do that all the time. We'll just start from the beginning. Take a breath. It's okay. Just take your time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you need more light on your sides? Do you need more light?
Yeah, that's a great, okay. That's okay. A great idea.
Thank you.
Okay.
There you go. When you're ready.
Take two. Okay.
It's okay. We just got vaccinated, and so
here we go.
Mr. Siebert.
All right. Have you been advised that you have the right to remain silent?
Uh-huh.
Have you been advised that you have the right to talk to a lawyer and to have him present at this time and at any other time you are being questioned?
Yeah.
Have you been advised that if you cannot afford a lawyer and want one, a lawyer will be provided for you?
Yeah.
Do you understand all of these rights?
Yeah.
Having these rights in mind, are you willing to give me a statement at this time?
Yeah.
Christopher, how is that?
You know what? I think you guys were right on track. So thank you for coming in.
After that wonderful, wonderful scene work that we just did, we do want to let you know that there was no new trial granted. There was no new trial granted, and Timothy Erickson was found guilty of first-degree murder by the jury. He's serving out a life sentence currently at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Faribault. And
wow. I have family in Faribault, Minnesota.
Really?
Yes, they've lived there for generations.
Well, look at this.
Do they go visit him?
I don't think they even know him. Maybe.
Can you imagine, though?
Imagine. Let's go see this guy.
Well, Timothy's brother, Mark, was actually sentenced as well to 2 years in prison for interfering with a dead body and aiding to an offender to avoid arrest. And, killers, this is where you come in, because if any of you know what happened to the other accomplices, please do let us know. You have helped us out in the past many times. And that, dear listeners, as Dr. Sieper said in the beginning, is the vampire murder. I mean, he said it. He didn't say the vampire murder, but he said, didn't they drink his blood? And so that's where I think we bookended it with, this is the vampire murder.
Now, Christopher, I want to discuss a little bit, but excuse me, I should, you've earned that title. Let me call you by the correct title. Dr. Sieber.
Yes.
You have family, you said, nearby, and it's Faribault. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Faribault, okay. Minnesota.
All right, you have family there. I have to tell you that I did log on and find a picture of Timothy. We normally don't like to do this, but I am going to report he's rather handsome.
Oh,
is and he? what if you had a relative though? Was like one of those people who's like, I want to marry that murderer in jail.
That's not that far fetched. I was watching.
It happens.
I was watching another Dateline last night. Hey, NBC. I was watching Dateline last night, and this guy, handsome as ever, goes to prison for killing his wife. And then another woman is like, I love you, Bill. I mean, it's moths to a flame. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It happens a lot. I have no experience, but that happens a lot with serial killers. Marriage proposals all the time. What is that? What is that trigger?
That's a very Ted Bundy thing. Ted Bundy, good looking.
Ted Bundy comes to mind. But also, why? I mean, because they're the bad boy?
Yes.
Maybe. Chris, yes. Jessica. Chris, yes. Same thing.
You want to get some of that bad boy? Yeah. But also not a threat because he's behind bars?
Right. But here's the thing. When I hear like bad boy, right, I'm like, oh my God, he stole a pack of gum from Walmart. Like that's what I think of when I hear bad boy. Instead of, you know, the possibility, let's just say that somebody's like, I want to get together with Chris Watts. He murdered his wife and kids, but he has definitely changed. And there, you know what? In the back of my mind, like I'm also scared he might snap again. That's so crazy. But like, I really think we can make it work. But I am nervous that he could snap at any time. But what if he doesn't? You know, it just keeps.
But it's passion and excitement.
Yeah, she's like, I'm on Bumble. I've been on Bumble, and I was like, somebody needs to surprise me.
He's just so misunderstood.
That's it. That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. But this type of thing, even when you try and dodge every bullet, as Timothy has done, I really cannot seem to find a way that he is not guilty of this crime by reason of insanity. That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think you can use that defense ever.
Christopher, what are your thoughts?
Well, the murderer, what was his economic background?
That's a great question, because at the beginning, that was one of the things that confused me in the story. First of all, it was difficult to find, I guess in 1988, this is when we still sent things via carrier pigeon, but it was difficult to find a lot about them. But I was struck by the fact that they're only 18 and 19 taking in other youths. I'm like, where are the parents?
What is the family situation? Where they?
I don't
they
know.
They probably not from? Very good. Yeah.
Probably not very good at all. But I mean, were they taking in the thing they're taking in homeless when they're 18? I mean, I moved to New York when I was 18, but it's not a Minnesota. That is not a Minnesota thing to first of all, leave home or to get your own apartment at that age.
Yeah. Are people do they keep to themselves there when you say it's not a very, very Minnesota thing?
they stay within their, I guess, their group. I mean, they stay within their, you know, their church or their, you know, and their family. But I think they probably just didn't have good parenting, obviously, or family support, just saying, hey,
when you kill
a hobo, that's bad. So don't do that.
Right.
But there's no moral compass. There's no moral compass there. No, probably and they never had one.
And he ruined his life. I mean, he ruined his own life with his choice. 18 years old, you're in jail now for the rest of your life. Congratulations. Oh. I mean, just what a tragedy, you know, not only for the man who was killed most especially, but all these youths. And like I said, I couldn't find anything about the accomplices that helped kick him and beat him. I'm sure they got jail time, but
they must have.
I suspect they also had some sort of deal to testify against him. He was the main
proponent of this.
But you didn't hear anything about the parents at all.
You know,
just kind of like they were their own little group that just kind of got together and killed somebody.
Christopher.
Yeah.
My God. Doctor. Not only do I love you, and you know I love you, I'm pretty sure Jess now loves you too.
I really do.
Thank you so much for your time. We're all so zoomed out, and here you are, and we love you for it. Thank you. You know what?
It's something to do. Yesterday it rained here. I'm out in rural New Jersey on a lake, and it rained all day, and I was inside watching television, and I was about to go crazy. So I was looking forward to this.
I love you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Love you too.
And I also with you.
Oh. All right. Get out of here. Love you.
I'm going. Goodbye.
Wonderful. Well, I don't think I need to say just how much I love my show husband, but I love my show husband.
I also love your show husband. And maybe someday we will all be together and maybe we could do a cabaret.
Called that would be great.
So long, Coco. So keep that in mind, killers. And keep it in mind that we love you too. You might not be our show husbands and wives, but we still thank you so much for listening. If we were all vaccinated right now, we still shouldn't kiss on the mouth, but we'd want to. We want to kiss you on the mouth. So we want you also to have a hot dog. Have a hot dog safely. And until next time, you know the deal. Keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It on Broadway and Twitter at Killing It on B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and a lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It on Broadway is a production of Killing It on Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.